We're back, and it's one of our favorite moments in the entire week, and that is when we get to visit with our friend Bill Walton, the star of The Bill Walton Show, among many other accomplishments. He's a many times triathlete, no matter his extraordinary age, I think maturity, shall we say. He is still doing this kind of thing. It's just extraordinary. He is also Master of the Universe, now recovering, I'm proud to say. We think we've brought him a long way, baby, but he's now also a leader of our conservative movement, not least as the vice chairman of the marvelous Conservative Political Action Coalition. And Bill, with all of that going for you, this is going to be a great show. I know it. How are you, sir?
I'm great. One thing I need to point out about triathlons, their age groups. And if you're my age, you get to a certain point, you can win your age group, and the reason nobody else is in it.
It's still a wonder to behold. That's all I can say. Sir, I wanted to ask you about another wonder of the free world, and that is, I wonder what on earth Janet Yellen is up to. She is the Secretary of the Treasury. She has made her second kowtow pilgrimage to Beijing in the course of, I think, the past 6 months or so. There's a lot of very colorful reporting coming from her travels there. And my particular favorite is apparently she is now being much ballyhooed by the Chinese social media platforms for her dexterity and the manipulation of chopsticks. What on earth is going on here with Janet Yellen?
Well, virtually everything. Let's first talk about the purpose of her trip. She's over there to talk very gently with the Chinese about what she calls overcapacity in wind, solar, and battery production capacity. And they're flooding the U.S. market with all the Chinese equipment to bring about the green agenda. And I don't need to diverge into why I think that that's a catastrophe to rely on them for our energy sources. But nevertheless, she's there. And she's very delicately not calling it dumping, because what they used to do in other industries before climate became a kind of a, everything's a shrine to climate. And recognize that Janet Yellen and John Kerry, Joe Biden, the entire administration believes that the greatest threat to the world right now is climate. It's not China. So in the first place, it's misguided. Second place, she's not really focused on any kind of points of leverage. Our friend Brad Thayer talks about the so-called engagement school. And the engagement school, and she's sort of the epitome of this, believes that if we can just engage with China, they'll become more liberal, they'll become a little richer, and they'll be nicer to us. And as we know, that's not happening. I mean, President Xi, while she's over there, has passed just in the latest passing, his latest attempt to crack down on foreign companies doing business in China with something called the Work Secrets Law. And now it looks like if you're in China, you're going to have to turn over your, quote, work secrets to the Chinese Communist Party. And so she's ignoring those signals. And also she's ignoring the fact that direct investment in China is at probably the lowest level it's been in decades. It's plummeted almost 80-90% in the last, last 12 months.
Some are calling it simply uninvestable. I think that you're among them.
I think I started with that one over a year ago, maybe. Maybe longer than that. It's certainly investable if you don't care about getting your money back.
Or somebody else's money if you're trading in, you know, pension funds and that.
You'll get your fee, but not your clients may not get
your fee. You're on a roll here, and I don't want to interrupt that. I just want to clarify. You're saying that what is not only a strategically ridiculous dependency that the Biden team has created on these Chinese energy sector, supplies, batteries and solar panels and wind turbines and the like. But they're actually now just kind of looking the other way at what would qualify as dumping. And I believe there are statutes on the books in the United States that actually prohibit that. Are there not?
Well, there is. There's an anti-dumping statute. And if they they exercise that statute, it automatically triggers all sorts of sanctions, what the Biden administration's loath to bring about. But let me give you an anecdote here about the tone in China. Steve Roach, who's the longtime Morgan Stanley economist, now I think he's had his own think tank for a while, has been a big friend of China. And for 25 years, he's made his way to Beijing for their investment conference. And generally over the years, saying great things about China and everybody ought to be in China and, quote, engaging with China. Well, just this year, he showed up and for the first time in 25 years, they asked him not to talk. And he can't give his speech. And it says, they quote the letter to him. They said, your recent comments on the Chinese economy have generated intense scrutiny and even controversy among the Chinese and international press. And the result of which, and I can go on, but it's basically saying you can't say anything bad about us. And so he's not allowed to speak. And moreover, he prepared a paper about the state of the Chinese economy that they refused to publish. And so there's a crackdown on people from the West saying true things about China. Janet's conveniently ignoring that. Now, let's talk about what she could be doing.
I'm kind of surprised they let him in under the circumstances.
Well, they're letting us in. I mean, they're still letting Steve Schwarzman in and Tim Cook.
But they're still towing the line, are they not?
Well, and they're also bringing lots of dollars, and Steve is only bringing words. And as we know, words don't matter much in China unless you're telling everybody what a great job President Xi is doing. He's not
wrong
bringing
words.
Capital nor any other resources. So, yeah, they can afford to, as they put it, diss him.
Mm. Silence him, I would guess, in the end. Yeah. I want to come back to the Yellen piece of this, if I can, because I get the feeling from what you've said, Bill, that those who are describing her as a useful idiot may not be far off the mark. And it's not to suggest she's not bright. It's to suggest that she's playing a role that Lenin famously ascribed to people in the West who would be willing to help their mortal enemies become more powerful and more dangerous to them. And that certainly describes what the Chinese Communist Party is up to at the moment. Exactly. We're going to get back into this with more of Bill Walton on the other side of a very short break. You do not want to miss his insights. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In just 47 days, the Biden presidency hopes to pull off what may be its most insidious and far-reaching violation of the oath of office sworn by every one of its employees. So help them, God. Rather than support and defend the U.S. Constitution, they will be replacing it with two international treaties that will render every American subject to, quote, global governance, unquote. Of course, you didn't vote to make the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, the dictator of public health in our country. Actually, you haven't even been consulted about this new arrangement. Fortunately, we are launching today an emergency campaign to defeat this stealthy travesty. Join us at sovereignticoalition.org in telling Joe Biden not now to his impending betrayal and demanding that the Senate do its duty by preventing such diabolical anti-constitutional treaties from crushing our freedoms. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Bill Walton is still with us, the host of The Bill Walton Show. I'm very pleased to say a great friend, as well as now a member of our Center for Security Policy Board of Directors, a man who appreciates what we do with the center, and I emphasize the word do, because that's what our job is. Yes, good research, but also getting things done, including on something we'll turn to here in a moment that Bill's been very, very helpful with, and that's the World Health Organization. If you want to find out more about what we do at the Center for Security Policy, and I urge you to do so, please go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And while you're there, check out that donate button, because we could certainly use your help. It makes possible, among other things, this program. Bill, you were talking a little bit about Janet Yellen and the perceptions of what she's doing, and I wanted to just touch base on this. You've done a program with two of our favorite contributors here, and I know good friends of yours as well, two members of our Committee on the Present Danger China, as are you. That would be Brad Thayer. Shit, I knew I was going to do that. That would be Bradley Thayer and the great Captain James Fennell. They are both authors of a wonderful book, Engaging Communist China, that is about America's greatest strategic failure. Talk a little bit about this program and the insights that it's given you and your audience to, which I think we'll be seeing it in the course of the day today, as a matter of fact, an opportunity to understand just how not only wrong, but really potentially deadly is this kind of engagement Janet Yellen is championing.
Well, Frank, let's first start with Jim and Brad's bona fides. Jim is head of the intelligence services for the Navy in the Pacific, and he spent several decades studying with China. And this riffing on what you just said about Center for Security Policy, watching what China actually does as opposed to what they say. And so Jim has a deep knowledge of Chinese strategic intentions. And Brad, of course.
Just to be clear, he's now retired, of course. But in the past, he was chief of intelligence.
He actually was retired because he told the truth
exactly
about what China was doing. And that's
terrible.
It's amazing how the truth can get you fired. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened.
Well, and Brad, if you have the courage to tell it, that's a lesson to everybody else, right?
Yeah, he was an early victim of that. I think that was about a decade ago that he began sounding the warning about China. And of course, everything he predicted then turned out to be true. And so we're still dealing that. But and then what Brad and Jim talk about is the perniciousness of what they term the school of engagement. And for the last four decades, beginning with the Clinton administration and certainly aided and abetted by Henry Kissinger all along the way, up until his death last year, it was a school of engagement. And that's what I referred to in the earlier block is, engaging with China, being nice to them, bringing them into the world economy, making them members of the World Trade Organization, et cetera, making them members of the World Health Organization, I might add. And what China's done is, and this is part of earlier President Ding's strategy of Biden, hide and bide, which is they began to infiltrate all these international agencies, begin to really work on strategic investing throughout the world with their Belt and Road Initiative. And there's a really telling point. China, when we started engaging with them, had 0.6% of the world economy in 1990. Now it's roughly 20%. In 1990, we were 35-40% of the world economy. Now we're about 20%, roughly the same as China. And so during that period, we've seen our share of economic activity shrink, which is all right. You want the world to be productive and grow. But really, China could not have done what it done without the direct engagement and involvement and assistance of the United States. And we're now seeing is that now that they've achieved that power, they've turned on it and say, well, look, we now see us as the global hegemon, not you, and out of the way.
Bill, you know, I think just a small corrective or clarification, perhaps. You want benign, peaceable, freedom-loving countries to prosper around the world, for sure.
I think I said that, but
well, anyway. you kind of made it sound like you want the world, but you don't want so much the world that is trying to destroy you, and that's a big piece of what China's about.
I'm a big fan of liberal democracy and free markets and human freedom, and I think
I wanted to make that clear.
I believe the more people can trade freely, the happier and freer they will be. So yeah I'm firmly
well,
in that camp.
If they are of that mind, that's the thing. And Janet Yellen is trying to help the Chinese mask that reality. They do not believe so. Bill, let me come back to what you just were teasing out there. The Chinese Communist Party, with, I think, our acquiescence, has become really the driving force behind the World Health Organization these days. It plucked from the obscurity of a sort of terrorist regime in Ethiopia, a Maoist by the name of Tedros Ghebreyesus, to become its director general. And now, unbelievably, the Biden administration is set, as you know, on helping Tedros Ghebreyesus become arguably the most powerful man in the world, yeah, with the authority to, you know, dictate public health policy everywhere. To the extent that this is afoot, Bill, what should Americans be understanding about the imminent treaties that would enshrine that arrangement at our great expense, nationally, at the state level, and personally as well?
Well, there's so many ways, there's so many aspects of this, Frank, but let me just summarize that what we saw with COVID was only seemed to be about, the agenda seemed to be only about 10% about the virus and 90% about gaining control over our freedoms and our health care. And the opportunity came
at the recommendation of Tedros Ghebreyesus.
Well, that's
clear.
The key word, Frank, at the recommendation. And if you look at the recommendation of the World Health Organization, they were every single one of them catastrophic, and countries dutifully followed. Now they want to turn recommendation into orders, and they've changed the language of the agreement from may or soft language like that to shall, and they've done it in over 100 places. And what they, you know, since we've been raising the alarms about this, they've been busily trying to redraft the document to put in all sorts of ancillary paragraphs, like, of course, none of this shall reduce each nation's sovereignty.
Trust us. We're out of time. But we're out of time. Go to thesovereignycoalition.org, a project of the Center for Security Policy, and our friend Reggie Littlejohn. Keep up the great work, my friend Bill, and come back to us next time. I hope the rest of you will do the same as well. Until then, go forth and multiply.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a man well known to at least those of you who listen to Securing America on the American Family Radio Network. We're very pleased and privileged to be part of that wonderful network. He is as well. His name is Dr. Alex McFarlane. He is, among other things, however, a television host with Truth and Liberty broadcast. He is also the author of some 20 books and a man who teaches about worldview at Caris College. It is a distinct privilege to have him as a friend, as well as a vital resource for this program, and to welcome him back. It's always gladdens my heart. It's good to have you, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. You're a great American. I learned so much from you, and it's always a privilege when you and I can converse.
You're very kind, and we have a mutual admiration society, I think we can call it. I wanted to start, Alex, where we don't often enough, frankly. We talk on this program, we talk at the Center for Security Policy and the work that we do there and in our various coalition efforts about various challenges our country is facing and what we need to do to protect ourselves against them, but inadequately about, I think, a kind of unifying field theory of what's really going on here, and that is spiritual warfare. You've devoted your life, I think it's fair to say, to thinking about that problem and helping the rest of us understand it. I'm mindful that a lot of the enemies that we encounter have as kind of a central purpose in their challenges to us, taking down our spirituality, taking down our faith, if you will, taking down our families as well, in many cases. Give us your take on this spiritual dimension of the challenges, the enemies, the dangers that we face as a nation.
Well, Frank, thank you. It's always a privilege to be on. And let me digress for just a moment and tell you that growing up on a farm in rural North Carolina taught me a lot about logic. There's a lot of cause and effect. Now, it would be decades before I would learn Aristotelian thought that, you know, if A, then B. But I realized at an early age that there is cause and effect. And when I was in college in the late 80s and during the middle of my first undergrad program, I became a Christian. And I remember very quickly it dawned on me how all of my professors seemed to hate Ronald Reagan. They hated Billy Graham. They hated the singing of the national anthem. And I was just a 21-year-old college student, didn't know anything about anything, Frank. But it was a puzzlement to me how all of my college professors that would tell of going to graduate school on grants. And I noticed that virtually none of my professors seemed to have ever worked a real job in the private sector. And God forbid they ever served in our armed forces. They hated America. They hated family, morals. They seemed to hate God. And what was percolating in my mind would become my life's work. Now, Frank, let me just say this, that cultural, political, economic, moral, and yes, spiritual issues, they all overlap. And nowadays, you know, regarding the Middle East, regarding Hamas and terrorism, regarding Russia, regarding China, the weakening of America always redounds to the strengthening of our enemies. And yes, we have enemies. I think people need to soberly acknowledge that in this world, the United States has friends, and we most certainly have enemies. And it is very naive to think otherwise.
You know, what you've just said is so important because, of course, what you're suggesting is that we have enemies within as well. And those that have been perhaps the most dangerous of all are individuals who have used their perch in academia, and not just at the, you know, higher education levels, but all the way down the food chain, to inculcate in our students some of their attitudes towards, you know, our greatest president, arguably, and certainly towards our country more generally. And it's chilling to think what the cumulative effect of that is over time. So it's very heartening that you are in the professoriate these days and doing your best there to counteract all this. But talk, you know, we had a very interesting program of our Committee on the Present Danger China last week, Alex, and I don't imagine you've seen it, but I commend it to you and to our audience. Sure. It's one of a series we've done, I think about 180 of them now every week. Go to presentdangerchina.org to register, get subscribed. You get them all. Again, a project we work on with our colleague and friend Brian Kennedy at the American Strategy Group, a project that we sponsor at the Center for Security Policy. Check it out at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Alex, this program was about the use that the Chinese Communist Party is making of the whole transgender agenda as a vehicle for doing just what you talked about, taking down our country, dividing us, weakening families, and you know, undermining our faith as well. How does that fit in, as you see it, to this larger spiritual struggle?
Wow. Well, listen, thanks for the work you do, and I look forward to watching that. Frank, I'm going to be very forthright with you. I'm going to be as transparent as I can be, and this comes from not only 35 years of research, but personally speaking on more than 200 university campuses. I mean, East Coast, West Coast, I have been to the classroom and dialogued with so many professors. And so here's what I want to say, that two things, the hyper-woke left American academia that are basically inoculating kids to hate America and to think in Marxist perspectives. The very same professors that are undermining America and engendering an animosity for God, morals, America, family, these professors think they know politics, but in reality, they are clueless posers. Now, let me say this too. The Chinese and the communists, they have a much longer view, and they think in long terms much more so than Americans very often. You know, famously, Henry Kissinger met with Chou En-lai, and they were talking, and Henry Kissinger asked Chou En-lai, "What do you think about the French Revolution?" And Chou En-lai said, "It's too soon to tell." Now, here's my point. The communists will use economics, politics, alliances that they otherwise would never forge. But if they are useful to the long view of spreading communism, global domination, taking down the one obstacle to global communism, America, they will do that. Now, what am I saying? I'm saying the LGBTQ trans lobbyists that are, believe me, Frank, as a counselor, as a pastor, I've dialogued with so many people. These poor souls are lost. They really don't know what life is about and even reality itself. I can assure the LGBTQ trans people, you have not found an ally in China. You've not found a friend in the woke socialist. You are merely useful to them. And whether it's Sharia law or Marxism, the moment these two juggernauts take over the world, I assure you, LGBTQ advocates, you'll be incarcerated, if not executed.
You bet you will. You know, this is such an important point. And come back to the Chinese in particular, the cynicism with which they are using, as we talked about in this webinar, TikTok as an instrument for fostering this idea that it's cool to be trans and everybody should get with that program in the United States, but they won't let a word of it be heard in China. That's totally different programming and so on. It's just another example of what I think you're putting your finger on here, Alex, which is the weaponization of these communities, these constituencies, if you will, and the various ways in which through information technology, through Hollywood culture and the like, they can be used to try to undermine us. And I think the place where we started the program is, you know, tragically, those that are authentically, you know, experiencing these symptoms of what is called gender dysphoria, are people experiencing a psychological disorder. And to the extent it's being exacerbated by our enemies for their benefit and our detriment, they have to be called on it, no?
Yeah, well, people are being exploited. And let me say, with my postgrad training in developmental psych, gender dysphoria is a means of trying to deal with pain. So the LGBTQ trans people are wounded, they're hurting. So the communists are exploiting and leveraging this for their own purposes to weaken and bring down America. And Frank, here is the irony. Let me just say recently, Easter of 2020.
We've got 30 seconds, sir.
Yeah. The using of Easter for transgender visibility, very sad in Europe and in America. Folks, if you want what we've had, freedom, stability, prosperity, you have to tolerate what gave us that. And what gave us that was a Judeo-Christian objective moral foundation.
Yeah. Tolerate would be the bare minimum. I think you have to embrace it, honestly. Thank you, Alex. I know you do, and so do I. And we embrace you, my friend. I hope that you will come back to us again very soon. And,
God bless.
Meantime,
thank
keep
you.
Up the great work you do in all of your outlets. We'll be right back, folks. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In just 47 days, the Biden presidency hopes to pull off what may be its most insidious and far-reaching violation of the oath of office sworn by every one of its employees. So help them, God. Rather than support and defend the U.S. Constitution, they will be replacing it with two international treaties that will render every American subject to, quote, global governance, unquote. Of course, you didn't vote to make the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, the dictator of public health in our country. Actually, you haven't even been consulted about this new arrangement. Fortunately, we are launching today an emergency campaign to defeat this stealthy travesty. Join us at SovereigntyCoalition.org in telling Joe Biden not now to his impending betrayal and demanding that the Senate do its duty by preventing such diabolical anti-constitutional treaties from crushing our freedoms. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. What a pleasure to be able to say welcome to our next guest. Her name is Carolyn Glick. She is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy. She is a columnist for the Jewish News Syndicate. She has her own podcast program, The Carolyn Glick Show. She is a fantastically formidable contributor, in other words, to the public policy debate on both sides of the pond, as it's called. And I think it's no exaggeration to say she's one of the best analysts and certainly the most articulate commentators on what is on the line at the moment for the state of Israel, where she now resides, and for her country of origin, the United States of America, as a result of the existential war that Israel is now embroiled in. Not because she chose it, but because she was attacked back on October 7th. Carolyn Glick was there at the time. She has been commenting on it ever since, and it is a privilege to be able to pick her brains about what's going on. Carolyn, welcome back, my friend. It's good to see you.
Thanks. It's fantastic to be on your program again.
Thank you. Well, you're doing it from stateside, as it happens,
that's right,
which is a good thing. We're glad you're here in the United States, because it turns out we need a little help with the Biden administration. And I wanted to talk to you about this, quite frankly. My concern, Carolyn, based on what I'm seeing and based on conversations we've had with, among others, our mutual friend and colleague, David Wormser, is now the seemingly unstinting betrayal of the Jewish state by the Biden team. And I'm not actually all that surprised, given its predilections from the inception, but I guess it is shocking nonetheless to watch it playing out. How do you see it?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it was obvious really from day one that the Biden administration was going to be hostile to Israel. In fact, from the campaign trail, they were saying things that were really inimical to Israel's national interests, like that, you know, at all costs, they were going to renew the nuclear deal with Iran and other things that, that place Israel in existential peril. Israel has faced American administrations over the years that have been less supportive than others. Obviously, the most supportive American administration was the Trump administration, that the Biden administration set out really from day one to undo all of the good that Donald Trump did for the Middle East, for America's position in the Middle East, for America's allies in the Middle East, including specifically Israel. And they went around unwinding all of his policies that brought peace to the region. And lo and behold, the policies that they've enacted in order to destroy Trump's legacy of peace and prosperity in the region is a legacy of war and suffering on a level that we haven't ever seen, and a level of barbarism that we've never experienced before. And so I think the thing that's shocking most to Israelis is not so much that the Americans are losing patience and they want a ceasefire, but it's the level of hostility that the administration is expressing towards Israel, the way that they're trying to humiliate our leaders, the way they're trying to destabilize our political situation, and how they seem to just be rushing to insult Prime Minister Netanyahu, to humiliate us, and to treat us like we're an American backwater or a colony, and that we shouldn't step out of place, that they get to decide everything down to the most minute level of tactical operations on the ground in Gaza. We've never experienced hostility and to this level before. We've never expected, even when dealing with hostile administrations, to be treated this shabbily. And of course, for many Israelis, it took several months to realize the underlying hostility of the Biden administration's policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians, vis-a-vis the Iranians, vis-a-vis Lebanon, which is controlled by Iran through Hezbollah, etc. Because initially, after October 7th, they were just flowing with sympathy and empathy and you know, saying they felt our pain.
Biden and went to Israel to make that point personally, right. No less. Right?
Right. And Biden came to Israel and he talked about how much he loves Israel and Golda Meir and all of these other things. And so from an emotional perspective, people believed that maybe they wanted to believe it was right after what happened. It was on October 18th that he came, that he was the greatest president ever for Israel. And Israelis believed that they really had a friend in Biden because of the way that he was talking. But you know, there were a few among us who were actually listening to what he was saying. And what he was saying from the outset was very, very hostile to Israel. These, you know, the insisting that we have to have a Palestinian state when 85% of Palestinians supported the savagery on October 7th. And support Hamas overwhelmingly, support the annihilation of Israel overwhelmingly. And Israelis realized after October 7th, there's no way to support a Palestinian state, which is why 92% of Israeli Jews don't support a Palestinian state, and 80% of Israelis overall oppose the establishment of a Palestinian state. But here, Biden, right after the invasion, he was saying it has to lead to a Palestinian state, to a two-state solution, and to a revitalized Palestinian authority. And Israelis weren't, they didn't have the emotional bandwidth to listen to what he was saying. They just wanted to hear the good stuff. And really, the one consistent aspect of his policy, as his tone changed from friendliness to hatred, which is what we're seeing now, the actual substance of the policy has remained consistent, that you know, it has always been pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. It has always been pro-Iranian and anti-Israel. And so, you know, for people who were paying attention, it isn't a surprise. What's really shocking, though, is the way they're trying to humiliate and insult us all the time.
Yeah. You know, you talked about insulting the prime minister. You talked about destabilizing the political system. I don't think it's too fine a point to say they're trying to overthrow the democratically elected government of Benjamin Netanyahu. And they're doing it in a very overt way. It seems funding mass demonstrations day after day after day, and otherwise trying to incite people against this prime minister. We have to take a very short break. Carolyn Glick, on the other side of it, I want to ask you, am I misperceiving this? Or if it's so, what on earth is an administration that prides itself on the defender of democracy is up to? Stay tuned for more. Hold the thought. We'll be right back. We're back. Carolyn Glick is with us virtually, but actually closer than usual. She is here in the United States, and we're so pleased that she is. And Carolyn, I just wanted to ask you to respond to this issue of the seemingly, well, naked effort of the Biden administration. And I want to include in that the CIA director, who seems to be spending a fair amount of time in the region, Bill Burns. Have some kind of color revolution or otherwise dispose of the prime minister of Israel, the duly elected prime minister of Israel. Am I misstating what seems to be afoot here?
So I think that it's very clear that the Biden administration, they haven't made any attempt to hide the fact that they want to overthrow the government of Israel. You've had statements all along from President Biden and from Vice President Kamala Harris and from other senior officials in the administration that they think that this is the most radical, the most right wing. They don't like the government of Israel. They want a different government in Israel. They've been very clear about this. And
Chuck Schumer was trotted out to
Chuck Schumer called put a directly
very direct call on right. Yeah.
Well, and he wasn't the only one. Kamala Harris did as well. And Kamala Harris made a statement that I think was very important, which was that they make a distinction between the people of Israel and the elected government of Israel. Except the thing is that the people elected the government. So the people don't see a distinction between the two. Obviously, the people who didn't vote for the government do, but they lost. And so, you know, you have a situation where the administration is openly saying that they want a new government in Israel, when the people of Israel don't want a new government of Israel, and that's
well. Let me ask you about that, Carolyn, because we're hearing increasingly that people do want elections, but they like the policies that the prime minister is favoring. Is that inaccurate?
It's inaccurate because the question is sort of it's a compound question, and it's presented as a simple one. It's not, do you want early elections? And as an early, like, you know, tomorrow, you say, do you want early elections? And you have a small number of Israelis. I don't know, maybe 20% or 30% want elections now. But the vast majority of Israelis want elections after the war is won, and after we have a commission of inquiry that investigates how it happened that Hamas was able to invade Israel on October 7th. What led to the military catastrophe that day that enabled this terrorist army to invade Israel at 30 points along the border and seize territory, seize control over communities, and massacre people? That's the question that people want answered before we go to elections, which obviously makes sense. I mean, you want to understand who it is you're voting for. You want to understand who's responsible for the single worst day in Jewish history since the end of the Holocaust. And so people want an accounting, and they don't want to go to the polls until they understand what happened. And so this is, you know, this is a totally rational position. And that's not, for instance, Schumer put out this fake statement. I don't know where he got the numbers from. There has never been a poll that showed that 70% of Israelis want to oust the prime minister from power and bring in a new government. The polling, you know, is all over the place on where Netanyahu stands. The most comprehensive polls show him ahead. And, you know, the more limited samples that are put out by these left-wing pollsters that have gotten everything wrong since the 1990s are saying he's way behind. So people choose their pollster, they choose the sample size they want, they put out push polls, and then the American government is using them as proof that it's okay to oust the government in the middle of a war that the vast majority of Israelis view as an existential struggle that's going to determine whether our state is going to survive or not.
Carolyn, there's so many pieces of this that I'm anxious to get your thoughts on, and we're very limited on time. And I thank you for giving us some of yours at this particularly challenging moment. Would you be able succinctly to describe the degree to which it is, in fact, the case at the moment that Israel is facing an existential threat? And frankly, unfortunately, not just from Hamas, but tie this all together for us, because we need clarity about what the betrayal of Israel at a moment such as this really represents.
So it's hard to do this succinctly, as you know, because this is really like a year-long graduate seminar. So I'm going to try to just give you a very... broad strokes. So Hamas is not some sort of a ragtag terrorist group of irregular forces who wear, you know, who walk around with daggers. It's on October 7th when it invaded, it was an army of 30,000 people, well-trained, massively armed, organized in units, and they invaded Israel with division-level strength. It's true that they carried out terrorist atrocities, but they first invaded as an army. And light infantry battalions that were then assisted with a massive missile assault of thousands and thousands of missiles raining down on Israel, and a cyber attack on Israel's first response units, including the ambulance services, the fire services, the electrical company, etc. So that's one. We always belittle the threats that we face from terror armies, Hamas being much smaller than the much larger, better armed and more sophisticated battle-hardened Hezbollah force of, I think, 50,000 soldiers that's perched on our northern border. We always thought that the problem was just Iran and its nuclear weapons program and everything else we could deal with. We also have 30,000 people from Iraq who are saying that they want to invade Israel from Jordan, from the east. So we have a massive threat that we're facing, and the Houthis in the south that are attacking Israel with cruise missiles and effectively carrying out a maritime blockade of the Red Sea from the Bab el-Mandeb. We thought that all of these were lesser threats, that they weren't a big deal. What we found on October 7th is that the terror complex of armies that Iran has built over the past two decades, actually each and every one of them separately and all of them together, pose an existential threat with a savagery that mankind hasn't seen since the Middle Ages at a minimum. And you add to that Iran's nuclear program, which is on the cusp of completion, and you see that Israel is facing a threat environment that would, you know, make any of the greatest strategists in world history cross-eyed trying to figure out how to deal with it. And at this moment,
Carolyn,
the United
we have
States
to leave
is
it at
siding
that.
With them.
I know it has, and it's against our vital interest not only to see Israel in this extremis, but also these are our enemies too. God bless you, my dear. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Next time, until then, go forth and multiply.